And I'm here today because I was asked to come here. And since I owe my life to you, I'll do absolutely anything that Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do. And that's carried me down some funny paths, but I love it. Let me first of all share with you the miracle of my life. I haven't had a drink of alcohol today. And there is no place on this planet that I would rather be than in this room right now. And there are no people I would rather be with than you. And there is nobody that has ever been born or ever will be born that I would rather be than me. And that's a by God miracle, because I spent most of my life trying to be anywhere but where I was. And I never did like the people I ran around with. And every time I looked at me, I found nothing, so I tried to be anybody but who I was. Everything I know, I've learned since I got here. I had a marvelous sponsor. Early on, after he convinced me that my very best thinking had brought me to my third penitentiary, so I better quit. He suggested that I forget everything that I thought I knew about anything, particularly about God. And he said, if you knew anything at all, you would not be here. He told me that even the truth wouldn't work for me, because I'm warped. I'm rubber-minded. You give me the truth and I put it in my head and my ego warps it so that I can use it. And by God's grace, I was able to do that. Christmas week of 1967 is the one that I like to remember because it finished it. I'm going to talk a little about penitentiaries only because that's where I've been, but please don't think that I was a big-time gangster. I was a petty thief and a crook. And my first penitentiary charge, I went to prison because I got lost. Yeah, there's a federal law against getting lost if you're in the Navy. And I was. I was baffled from the very beginning because of incidents like that, and you helped me understand the sickness that I had. See, I loved the Navy. I really did. I ran away and joined the Navy because Denver got too hot for me. But when I got there, I loved it. I liked being at sea, I liked the camaraderie, I liked fitting in, and I loved it. But they kept giving me these 24-hour passes, and I kept coming back days later. And it baffled them, and it baffled me. And then I met you, and you told me what's wrong, and why that happened. You see, I suffer from the disease of alcoholism, which means that I have an allergy to alcohol. If I had an allergy to tomatoes and I ate tomatoes, I'd break out with an itch. I have an allergy to alcohol. If I take a drink of alcohol into my system, I break out with a screaming Mimi itch for another drink of alcohol. And in those days, the minute I started drinking, I started to try to find it. It was out there somewhere. And I couldn't go back to that ship until whatever was going on was over. And the last time it was a 23-day trip, and they moved the ship to Korea, and I ended up in the federal penitentiary in Japan, and through some marine brigs, and I came out of there just madder than hell, and truly baffled. I was 19, and my life was over. I had failed and failed and failed. But the worst of it was, all of you drank for the same number of reasons that I did. I drank to kill pain, I drank to feel pain. I drank to be somebody, I drank to be nobody. I drank for all those reasons. The most horrible of all, there were days I drank because I had to drink. And when I was 19 years old, just drinking alcohol didn't do for me what I needed to have done. It didn't change me. It didn't make me bigger or smaller, faster or slower. It just got me drunk. And I have never liked being drunk. When I get drunk, I puke. And I fall down, and I make funny noises. And I've never thought that was fun. I liked everything in between the first drink and doing that, but that quit happening. for years I drank after that. And I also did other things because they took me to a doctor at that time to work on my head because we all knew I was crazy. And they gave me methamphetamine hydrochloride, speed. And I was home free. So for the number of years after that, I drank alcohol, took speed, ate acid, did whatever on any given day, gave me 5 minutes of the edge that I had to have. And when that quit working, I just did it anyway. So I came to Christmas week of 1967 out of my second penitentiary in desperate condition because nothing worked anymore. And that's scary as hell. Nothing worked anymore. I couldn't get out of bed that week until my connection got there to give me a fix so I could hit the street and get the... I used rum and wine at that time to cut all those rough edges and get us both together. And I love that week because that's the week that I finally got to see me. Now, I understand that we have somebody new here tonight, and I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope to hell, if you're new here today, that you've had this week. I prided myself on never turning on young people. My connection was 16 years old. I had turned him on, and I was using him as a runner because I couldn't do it. And I saw that. For reasons I still don't understand, my two little boys were still in my custody. They kept taking them away and giving them back and taking them away and giving them back. And we were living in a $40 a month basement apartment underneath a lady who had cats. I'm not talking about a couple of fine little tabbies. This lady had cats. Have you ever been around cats? Her place was cleaner than mine was. And I saw that. When I was 14 years old, they showed us a movie about junkies. Man, I didn't want to be one of them, ever. So I've never had heroin. Because my keen alcoholic mind said only heroin makes junkies, so if I don't take it, I won't be a junkie. I woke up one morning that week and looked at the guy that was with me, and I was petrified. I says, man, we're in a junkie pad. And it was my house. If you've been on the road, you know that there's money laying in the streets of America. It's not enough to make you rich, but it's there. I've been on the road long enough to know that all you have to do is walk around and look down long enough, and there's bucks out there. On Christmas Day, the kids and I went down to see my mom and dad, and along the way we found a dollar in the snow. See, we were living on welfare, and we didn't have any money. So that dollar bought our Christmas tree. If you're planning to go out and be a maniac again, on Christmas Day, on any lot that I've ever run across, about 4:30 in the afternoon, you can buy any tree they got for a dollar. That's where we got our tree. So I bought the biggest one they had. We lived in a little bitty room, so you know. The thing that broke me, thank God, that we got to my folks' house and my dad met us at the door and he said, I'm sorry, you can't come in. Your mother says she can't stand watching you die anymore. Now, I thought for years that was the first time that had happened. But as my memory begins to return, there were other times that Dad had to sneak us in because Mom didn't want me around. But that's the day that I saw what I had done to my mother. And then he snuck us in anyway. And I got hit with what I'd done to my father. He jeopardized his home on Christmas Day to see us. And God Almighty, I saw what I'd done to my kids. At six, my older boy thought that everybody lived on the road. We did. And everybody we knew did. And some somebody told him about school. And I had an unmanageable child. He wanted to go to school. You can't go to school on the road. The feds busted me that time and he got to go to school. But I saw what I had done to my family. My dreams were dead, their dreams were dead, and we grew up with some pretty good dreams, man, we're not. They were dead. I think I took an inventory that day because I took an honest, square look at Don, and what I saw made me so sick that I laid down and took a massive overdose of speed, drank everything in the house, and chose to die rather than live one more day like that. And if you're new here today, think about that. Rather than be that person one more day, I chose to die. That's sick as hell, but that's surrender. I quit. And I have to tell you about the power of God from this point, because that's what I've been experiencing ever since. I was really upset in the morning because the police came to arrest me. And that's a hell of a deal to run into after you just killed yourself. They had 9 charges this time, and they were talking 3 years to life on the first one, with the promise that if I beat them on that one, they'd bring them one at a time and tie me up in the Denver County Jail forever rather than put me back on the street. They were really upset with me. And I laid there for 5 months, and I'm convinced that just because I was willing to do anything rather than be that again, some things began to happen in me. Now, first of all, jail was pretty nifty the first few days, as tired as I was. If you haven't been there yet and you're getting ready to go drink and plan to go there, the rules are these. I lie to you for 10 minutes, you lie to me for 10 minutes, then we both go take a nap. That's it. That's it. That's a hell of a way to live. I can vividly remember, we talked about what we were going to do when we got out. And it was always the same. We were big shots. I couldn't get up $100 for the bondsman to get out. And neither could any of the other guys I was talking to, or they'd have been out. So when we got out, we were going to go into the mountains of Colorado with Coors beer and dark Bacardi rum and little grass and little dope, and we were going to get high, and that was it. And I can remember saying that. And I can also remember that didn't feel like that here anymore. I didn't want to do that. You know why I'm grateful to you? I didn't know any better until you came and told me that you don't have to live like that. Isn't that weird? The whole world comes at me and says, can't you see what you're doing to your family? And I see it so well I have to go get drunk. Yeah, I can see that. Can't you see what you're doing to your life? Yeah, I can see that. You're the only ones that said, hey, you don't have to drink anymore. Ever. If you're an alcoholic, whose destiny it is to be drunk, you don't ever have to drink again. And I can hear it because of the people that were saying it to me. Okay. You found me in the Colorado State Penitentiary fish tank, and I wasn't supposed to be there. Okay. Let me tell you a little about power. The state and the feds, I owed the feds 4 years at that time because I was on federal parole when this happened. They got together and they decided I was sick. I was too sick. And they all thought I was a drug addict. So they conspired and got together and said, if you will plead guilty to this charge, we'll drop the rest, give you a little sentence, suspend it, and send you to Fort Worth. To the federal drug hospital. Now, two things happened to me when they offered me that deal. And to this day, there's still two of me at work. One side of me was willing to go anywhere that there was help. I was in desperate shape. I couldn't live and I couldn't die. And here I was living and breathing. I'd have gone anywhere because I wasn't afraid of going to prison. I knew that what they were talking about had put me back out again in a very short period of time. Because the other side of me said, if you put me in a hospital where there are books and doctors, I'll be on the street in 6 months. My whole life has been that of sitting quietly while you tell me who I am, and then I play that back to you until you're happy with it and send me on my way. I agreed, the state agreed, and the feds agreed. If you know anything at all about power, you know that I should have been in Fort Worth a week later. A week later, I'm in the Colorado State Penitentiary fish tank saying, wait a minute, this isn't the summer camp I signed up for. I truly believe that God knows, had I gone to Fort Worth, I'd be dead today. See, I'm not a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. And they wouldn't have treated me right. I got to where I had to be to hear what I had to hear, and if you're new here today, I hope you've heard it. I believe that any alcoholic anywhere going to that first meeting is in exactly the right place to hear exactly what they need to get them back to the second meeting, where they will hear exactly what they need to get into the third meeting, and so on, until something clicks. God, I love my early AA sponsors. I believe in sponsorship. If you'd put the book in my hand and said, read this, I'd be dead. I couldn't read. I couldn't put things together in a whole sentence. But I had to kind of find, one of them looked at, oh, Doc, God bless him. Said, I'm Doc. I'm an alcoholic, and that means that I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life has become unmanageable. And if any of you smart bastards think you can still manage your lives, look at the reward the state just gave you for the nifty job you've been doing. The miracle of that is that I heard Doc. The old guy, other guys in that fish tank didn't hear him. I heard him. They invited me to an AA meeting when I came out of the fish tank. They took the time to put a little slip in my brand new cell when they moved us over there, reminding me that that afternoon there was an AA meeting. Now, it may not be important to you, but to go to that AA meeting, we had to give up our yard privileges or our movie. And on Saturday afternoon, where I was living, that was it. And that's important when that's all there is. And the movie doesn't even have to be good, it usually wasn't. But I decided to go. Now, at that time, this AA meeting was part of what was known as a 12-step study school. In order to belong to the big group, which met on Friday night, where they let real people in from the outside, you had to complete 5 weekends of the 12-step study school. And this first guy, when we got up there, told us as a little group, said, for the next 5 weeks up here, you have nothing to say. If you knew anything, you wouldn't be here. We suggest that you listen. And they began to share powerlessness. The first step, the unmanageability of our lives. And they shared this, there were three of them, and they shared by sharing themselves with us. I'll never forget Bruce, God bless him. He hit me with something that day. I've always screamed out, nobody understands me. Nobody thinks like I think. Nobody ever felt this way. Bruce talked about it. He was in there for a natural life because he killed some people in a shootout one afternoon in downtown Denver when he was 17 years old. Because he woke up that morning with the feeling that nobody on this planet cared whether he lived or died. And it made him so upset that he started drinking. And instead of killing the pain that day, it got him involved in it. And he went downtown and killed some people. Now, I wasn't the kind of gangster that could run off with a pistol in my hand. I'm a sneak. But I have wakened in the morning knowing that nobody cared whether I lived or died, tried to kill the pain and gotten involved in it, did more bizarre things. So I heard him. One of my other sponsors was a fellow from Guam. God bless him. If you were casting movies about Chinese pirates, Phil would be the king. Phil was the most gentle human being I've ever met. But when Phil drank, he liked to throw things out of windows. And it was usually people. And it wasn't always on the first or second floor. And they were awful mad at him, too. Now, Phil had been sober for 7 years in that penitentiary. And I was his first pigeon. And this sweet, gentle, loving man let me know, I lived on the fourth tier, that I was going to stay sober or ill. He wasn't losing me. But Phil talked about the program, and I've never met a man that loved his family more. But he would stand behind that podium and in that school, and he would talk to me about how he worked this program for Phil, not his wife, and not his kids. So I tried several times to clean up for them. It didn't work. He helped me to understand that if I don't do it for me, I don't have them, that's all. Bruce told me the most important thing in the second step for me was the word restore. He said it indicates that you weren't always a raving maniac. There was a time in your life when you were sane. We will assume, he said, that you went insane about 3 seconds after birth, so we don't have to track it too far. because this isn't therapy. But that simple little promise, God can restore me to a former state and I get to start all over. Because I was terrified of that business of being insane. I knew I was insane. On paper, they had me as a psychopath and a sociopath type 2. And all I know today about either of those is that they're both untreatable. That's why you don't send psychopaths to the hospital, you send them to prison, because you can't help them. And I was terrified of having to get sane, and the only way I knew, which was to spend the rest of my life trying to unravel what had not been possible to unravel in 32 years. He said, we don't do it that way. He said, you're not clinically insane anyway. You have all the symptoms. My God, you behave like a maniac. He showed me that I suffer from alcoholic insanity. And in our big book, there's a definition of that that's so simple even in my sixth state I could grasp it. It's in the story about a young car salesman who thought one afternoon, because he'd been sober a while and was eating, he could have an ounce of whiskey in his milk. And it says whatever the precise definition is, we call that plain insanity. Lack of proportion in the ability to think straight. That's what's wrong with me. If one wolf take 10, two jobs, two wives. I've done that. I did that sober. And I'm rubber-minded. I can't think straight. That's the second part of my disease. If I never take alcohol into my system, I will never have that insane craving for more alcohol. But I have a mind that either cannot or will not, or for reasons that I don't even want to understand, on certain days can't remember that, or will trick me, or will give me this obsessive need to have a drink. And I'm powerless over that mind. That's been my biggest fear anyway. I've known that, but I'm powerless over my mind. And if there is no power on earth, no human power, in me or outside of me, among you even, that on the day when that piece that's missing can't function, when I will get into thinking about a drink beyond my capacity, nothing can stop me. I must find a power greater than myself, and it must be a spiritual power. Now that scared me a little bit. You know, I was beat to death. But I still had one reservation about spiritual things, because I'd tried most of them. I was truly convinced that if I surrendered my life to God and decided to do his work for me was to go to the corner of Colfax and Broadway in Denver and hand out Watchtower magazine and ask perfect strangers, have you been saved, brother? And even in that state, I wasn't ready for that. You know why I was afraid of that? I saw a guy doing that. And they helped remind me, he's already got somebody down there doing that. He don't need you doing it. I became willing that if that is what he wants for me, I will do that with great joy. If you're new here today and you're concerned that you may not be able to take these steps right, quit worrying about it, because you won't. There's no way in the world any alcoholic coming in here is going to do this right. There's no way any alcoholic coming here who tries is going to do this wrong either. But there is a best way. If you want maximum results, let me suggest that you do it the way that was shared with us in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Step-by-step direction, which is what I needed. I started hanging around because there were some things that you had that I wanted. Bruce had something I wanted real bad. He got in and out of his cell any damn time he wanted. And it baffled me, because I sure didn't. Every time I've been locked up, I've arranged it so that I got to be tier clerk, because I don't like being locked up. And the tier clerk gets the door tripped. I wondered what he had. He had something else that I wanted. He told me that it was possible for him to think one thought at a time. God, did I want that. It was noisy up here. You see, being nobody, I had taken on the character of every human being I'd ever seen or met or read about. And it was noisy up here. I'd tried for years to get something to hook up right. And he said he could think one thought at a time. He had me hooked. I want to know how you do that. I can tell you today that it is possible at times for me to think one thought at a time. And there are blessed moments in my life when I sit quietly somewhere, I don't think at all. I'm beginning to be a little bit unsociable again because I like that so much that I just spend the rest of my life sitting quietly somewhere, thinking nothing at all. I took the third step because I wanted to be instantly saintly and saved and quiet. Now, I'm an alcoholic. If it goes boom, it's real to me, and if it doesn't, it isn't. And I took that third step and had the worst experience I've ever had in my life because nothing happened. Good or bad, nothing happened, and that scared me to death. And I ran off to my sponsor because I'd learned by then if you got a sponsor and they suggest you do something and you do it and you don't get the results you think you ought to get, go bet that. I did. And he said, "You dummy," he gave me back my name. He took me from 38,984 to dummy. He said, "You'd be grateful that you didn't have a flash of light. They damn near killed you all your life." And then he did the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous does better than anybody. Each one of us is allotted a certain amount of time, and that's it. He took some of his time, which I know is precious to him, and he gave it to me as he shared what he had found. And I knew he was telling the truth because this guy was the guy that had killed people, and I could look in his eyes and see he couldn't kill anybody. He said, "You know, God probably knows that you can't stand one more big shock anyway. And he'll probably come to you like he came to me." And he talked about this gentle unfolding awakening that had taken place. I wanted that, and I said, "How do I make it real?" And he sent me off to do an inventory. He said, "God will reveal himself to you as you reveal yourself to you." And 2 hours later, when I finished it and came back to him the fifth step, he destroyed me. He says, "You wrote that to impress me. That's garbage. Get away from me." For the first time in my life, I had risked being honest to belong. He told me it was garbage. And I ran off quickly and took that fifth step with another fellow that, by God, I knew would listen. And I had one of those awakenings at the end of that. He spent that 2 hours. Every time I'd say something, he'd convince me I wasn't all that bad and justify my behavior. But I walked away from there with a certain and sure knowledge that I was back in my trap. I'd spent my whole life picking people to justify my behavior to me. And if I had kept doing that, I was a dead man. I call that a spiritual awakening because I am convinced any time any alcoholic has any comprehension of truth, that's a spiritual awakening. And I was frightened because I knew I'm doomed. So I went back and I did some more praying, and then I tried to do this thing the way they had been showing us in the school and the way the big book showed us. If you don't want to know the truth, for God's sake, don't do that. We got a little system that'll get the truth at you before you know it's there. I'm going to share one little piece of you because I love the process. 1966, Federal Narcotics Agents came into my house. They do not come gently. They literally came through the front door and the back door and the side window, knocked me to the ground and handcuffed me and spit on my neck. And my 4-year-old son let out a shriek and his big cop put a gun to his head. And I went from resentment to hate in about 30 seconds. He was on my list when I finally made it. It said what I was supposed to do was make a list of all the people I was mad at or had a grudge against. And by God, he was there. And there were 22 reasons I was mad at him. Now that's egotistical as hell. One short little bust and I got 22 reasons that I'm mad at him. I just cooked up a great scheme to get back at him earlier on. because I came out of that one and was free for a while. It suggested I take a look at what that was affecting in my life. And it was everything. And I tried very hard to take the attitude that that book suggests, that Eli, myself, was perhaps spiritually sick, and I can grant that. Take sick people to do that kind of thing. And I still hated him. Then you slipped me. You got me. Because the next sentence, and I was doing it before I knew what I was doing, said that I was to set aside the wrongs the others had done and resolutely look for my own fault. And it burst upon me that I had invited him into my house. I'd been smuggling dope out of Mexico and not paying the tax. And that is illegal. And any time I do anything, I'm fair game for whoever it is to watch these people who do those kind of things. I am responsible for my own actions. My troubles truly were of my own making. And I could finally, for the first time in my life, see that. To this day, as I look back over my life regularly, I've never been in any kind of scrape that I didn't get to on my own. I've never been drug off anywhere to get in trouble. It opened the door for me. I learned about fear. I always thought fear lived here, because that's where I feel it. Fear lives here for me. Unnamed fears, terror. God, I live with fear. Could never tell you why I was afraid, it just was. And the booze stopped it. They made me make a list of all the things I was afraid of, and it became funny. I'm afraid of being alone, and I'm afraid of being with people. I'm afraid of living, and I'm afraid of dying. I'm afraid to think, I'm afraid to go insane, I'm afraid to be sane, I'm afraid of dogs, cats, people, blah, 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 blah. And it was through that fear inventory that I learned about God's mercy. The rest of the world has to have all these fancy tools to deal with fear. You and I are told, and in my experience it's true, that when I'm afraid, all I have to do is ask God to kindly remove that from me and direct my attention to what He wants me to be. He obviously doesn't want me afraid. And it was over. I was 2.5 years before I could take a sex inventory. I ate Y-mine inhalers and shot Speed and read Playboy magazine. When I finally did take it, it fit on the back of that cart. I didn't live out there, I lived in there. But I learned another thing about mercy. Time healed me. God used that 2.5 years to heal a very sexually sick young man. And after I was healed, then I could do and examine what I've been doing. See, I'm a big book thumper and a step sponsor. But I worry about becoming too technical, because it's a spiritual exercise, not a technical exercise. And without love and mercy, none of it would make any sense to me. Oh, God, was it funny. I went back to my cell after I finally finished a fifth step, and it was at that fifth step that I had a magnificent experience. I've been alone all my life. I've always felt alone. The closest thing I ever got to was that dog that used to sit and listen to me and not talk back. In the midst of the fifth step, and I picked a kid who'd been in the program the same length of time I had, because he said, pick somebody who won't be overly affected. And he was crazier than I was. There's nothing I could say would have bothered him. He took an afternoon out of his life and sat and listened to me. And did not justify anything. He simply listened to me. And somewhere that afternoon, instead of being alone, there became two people in the room. There was me, and there was Jim. And I didn't understand it that day, but I understand it today. I was alone because I had never, ever admitted any of you were real all by yourselves. It was me and who I needed you to be. And that's all there was on this planet. That day there was me and Jim, and he was there all by himself. It had nothing to do with me. And I have not been alone since. Even in my solitude, I am not alone. And I do love the solitude. I entered my evangelical stage about then. I love to talk to people who suddenly get out of the chair and run out to save every alcoholic on the planet. I know they're okay. There comes a time after you have awakened to the Spirit of God when you can't sit still. You have to run around the world by... You don't have to drink again. Come here, come here, come there. Do this, do that. I ask God in His mercy to please not let the things that I hadn't found yet kill me before I got to them. And I found some more yesterday. And I'm still here, and I'm still sober. We must be working. I got free, locked up for the night, in the Colorado State Penitentiary, working on my eighth step. My sponsor knew me pretty good. He said, "Dummy, now we got all this done. You know what you've done to all these people, but you have no idea what that did to them. So I want you to go back to your cell and take those names off of this list, and I want you to add every other name you can think of, because we're going to just assume that if you met them, you heard them somehow. I want you to take those names and take each one and put it on a separate sheet of paper. Then I want you to close your eyes and picture that person right in front of you and see if you can look them in the eye and say to them, 'If I've done you harm, will you please tell me what I have to do so that we can get the books to balance?' And see if you can feel willing to do that with everybody." There was no great weight taken from me, but I was lifted that night and set free. Because I want to look anybody in the eye and say, "If I have caused you harm, you tell me what I have to do so that you and I can get the books to balance." One of my biggest problems was that I was always either better than you were or worse than you were. And how the hell are you going to talk to anybody in that state? Now, they kept me locked up for another 8 months because they didn't know I was free. And about that time, I found out what it was that Bruce had that got him in and out of his cell whenever he wanted. He was 12-stepping those of us that couldn't get out. The people in that penitentiary so believed in this program that those who finished the 12-step study school and wanted the 12-step, the new ones coming in, were allowed to get out of their cells and free access to the cell house to sit out on that tier and talk AA to them. And I found that out because I volunteered, and damn if I couldn't get in and out of my cell, just like Bruce did. They gave me my first service job at the end of the fifth week. They gave me a big book. They said, "The next group of guys are yours." And I'm sure glad I had that big book. To this day, I sponsor the same way. If I sponsor you, you show up at my house at least once a week, and we read that big book and do what it says. I don't know any other way to do it. I don't know why you do these things over and over again. I do, because I believe if I'm going to sponsor you, I've got to be doing the same thing you're doing. It's kind of fun. I get all the psychopaths and the sociopaths. And I got Sam. God love you. I could spend 3 hours telling you about my amends, because that's where I came to life. And I'm going to take a little time and tell you about amends, because it's so vital. I damaged my family. I damaged my children. I damaged everybody I came in touch with, but particularly the family. After what I'd done to my mother, there was no way I could just go to her and say, "I'm sorry, Ma." And I knew that. That isn't what amends mean. It means to change, to make restitution. How the hell do you make restitution? Well, they taught me. After I have said, "If I've harmed you, will you please tell me what I'm supposed to do to get the books to balance?" I'm supposed to shut up and listen while you tell me. I found a way to say that to my mother, and she told me. She said, "Don, all I ever wanted for you is to be happy. So on a really regular basis, I show up at my mother's house happy." It was 6 years before she thought I was going to stay sober. She told me that. But since I had no right to ever expect her to believe anything I had to say, that was just fine. You see, I wasn't staying sober for her. I'm staying sober for me and making restitution to her. She and I had a ball today. We had a lot of fun. How about my dad? My God, I tried to be him. My father has an IQ that cannot be measured. He lives in a 48-room house full of stuff, and that's his mind. I can't be that. I live in a 9-room house and can't keep up with it. He taught me a very important thing about making amends. I started to go over the list of things I had done to him. And he said, please stop. I know all that. All you can do by telling me that is to hurt me again. Let you and I just go from here. And we've gone from there. We have a ball. There are some direct things I have to do for him. God knows how much money I stole from him. I don't. He doesn't. So once in a while, I just go by with a $20 bill and give it to him. Or buy him some tapes or something. And I shovel the rocks. I used to shovel the rocks every time I need money for $2. Today, I just go shovel the rocks. And if he needs rough work done, I do that. If he needs driven to the store, I do that. Because I like spending time with my dad. He is a kick. Have you ever lived, been around a person who's got a 48-room house full of stuff? He's fun. How about the kids? I drug my kids in and out of crash pads and foster homes and police stations. And there isn't a damn thing in the world I can do to ever change the fact that I did that. And I did some grave damage to my children. There came a time we almost had to lock my older boy up because he was having blackouts, long blackouts. And he was into violent behavior and he was hiding in our basement and destroying our home. And I'd spent a year and a half trying to rescue him. We had EEGs, EKGs, blood tests, everything you can imagine. And the day came when I had to say, Terry, there's nothing more I can do for you. You're going to have to find your answer like I found mine inside yourself. And I asked him if he still believed in God. And he said, Dad, I don't think so. But because you do, I will keep praying. Two weeks later, he came up out of our basement and said, let's check my eyes. And you know that's what it was? He had a strange eye condition. And he didn't see the world like the rest of them did. And he and I began to understand each other, because I've lived like that all my life. Weird and strange and left out and not seeing the world right. And we got glasses on him, and so he could see the world the same way that everybody else did. And then he and I got to talk a lot. All of a sudden, he started talking with me. He's a computer accountant with the Air Force now, doing just fine. My young son is going to walk through that door someday. I damn near killed him too, trying to rescue him. In fact, the last time I was at Scott's Bluff, we got a call in the middle of the night that he had a head-on collision and put himself and a bunch of other people in the hospital, stoned and drunk out of his mind. After a year and a half of that, and a lot of prayer, on a night when it was 17 below zero, somehow I found the courage to say, you gotta go now. Not in the morning, now. You see, the unity and the structure of my family is more important than any individual in it. I learned that here. Without unity, none of us can make it. And I had to put my boy in the snow that night and trust that he was one of God's kids too and would be watched over, because he had to do what he had to do. And if I kept rescuing him, it was guaranteed he was dead. But if I turned him over to God, at least there was one chance in 1,000 he might make it. Oh, he hated me for a while. I was given the strength not to see where he stayed. I found out later he was sleeping on an old mattress under some stairs. He told me since that that's the only thing I could have done. We're getting along fine today. He worked with me. My grandson is the joy of my life and my revenge on that young son. He's a pistol. As I began to make amends, I realized that I had work to do. We have work to do. You know what we belong to? God, what we belong to. Because of you, I've gotten to see a view of AA that I never saw before. This is the first generation on this earth that I know of where alcoholics do not have to die alcoholic death. And my research has taken me clear back to old Noah. There's a case. God gave him a pretty big job to do, and the first thing he did was argue about how much snake bite medicine he got to take. Found dry land and planted grapes. And as soon as they became full grapes, he stomped them into wine, got roaring drunk, beat his family up, and threw them out. That is not social drinking. And from that day to this, until that drunken stockbroker and that drunken doctor got together, except for brief bursts, alcoholics have died ugly deaths, and their families have done the same. We belong to the organization that God put here that knows they don't have to do that. What a marvelous thing for a world kid like mine to know that the only valuable thing I have is my garbage. You and I get to go into homes where people are dying and going crazy because of this damn disease. And our very presence and the willingness to share the wretchedness of our lives with God in God's hands means they don't have to do that. Maybe that's something to belong to, something like that. That isn't getting up in the morning and going and doing something. That fits my need to have a cause. And I never get to take the credit for it. Because on my own, the best I can do is get locked up in the penitentiary. We got this book. I got to see a picture of this book this year. You think about it. That's been on the market now in our hands since 1939. Now, you give any other piece of literature to this many alcoholics over that period of time, at least one of us would be able to rewrite the damn thing and make it better. And none of us have been able to do that. Think about that book. Here's this drunken doctor and drunken stockbroker are counting noses on a regular basis. They got something going and they know it, and they're counting noses, and one night the nose count comes up to 40. And that is so momentous that there are 40 people out of 200 million staying sober that they figure we better write a book about that. And I belong to that. You want to know about power? When was the last time in your drinking days you were in a room with this many alcoholics for an hour and nobody interrupts? Nobody hits anybody? Nobody's gotten drunk? That's a lot of power. And I belong to that. I have no way of telling you how much I love you, except to tell you how much I love you. I will walk to the gates of hell with you if you want to get sober. If you want to drink, you're going to have to go to hell on your own. I can smell that meat cooking, so I'm going to wrap this up. With the gift that was given me, I spent my whole life trying to find out who I was. I had become like all legions in the Bible, everybody I'd ever met. And I was tired. And then you came to me, and the way you came to me was like the fellow that had seen the Statue of David for the first time. I don't know if you've seen it or even pictures of it, but this thing breathes. And he went to Michelangelo and he said, "How in the world did you do that?" And Michelangelo said, "Well, I took a block of stone and I chipped away everything that didn't look like David, and that's what I've got left. That's this thing I belong to. With God as the sculptor, and you people, and the steps, and the fellowship, and the things we do, as the chisel, one day at a time, we're chipping away everything that doesn't look like Don. And so far, this is what we got. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. Now we'll